So, and a lot of them now, I find, are encouraging women to actually have inductions at 39 weeks or 38 weeks with no clinical indication. And if they don't deliver by a reasonable hour after they've been induced, they usually seize it before 8 o'clock in the evening so that the obstetrician is not woken up in the middle of the night. And that is just unethical.
Hello, I'm Michelle Murphy, physiotherapist specializing in women's health and wellness. You are listening to Choose to Thrive, the podcast series connecting women through the power of shared experience. Remember, no matter what's going on in your life, you are not alone. So thanks for joining the conversation. And since you're here, let's dance. Hello there, and welcome to episode 4 of the Choose to Thrive podcast. Today, I'm delighted to bring you my recent conversation with obstetrician, gynecologist, and associate professor Kenneth Nathan. Dr. Nathan has 27 years' experience in the field of obstetrics and gynecology. 15 of these years were spent in full-time public tertiary hospitals with more than 2,000 deliveries per year. Currently, you can find him at his private practice clinic, COGSS, that's C-O-G-S-S, at St. John of God, Mount Lawley Medical Centre, and I'll include a link to his website in the show notes. Dr. Nathan is passionate about his profession, and he's a strong advocate for vaginal delivery as well as VBAC, or vaginal birth after caesarean. He's not afraid to speak his truth, even if he treads on some toes in the process, and quite frankly, it's pretty refreshing in a field that seems to have swung towards hypermedicalization. Our discussion covers topics such as the current risk-averse culture impacting obstetric decision-making and high caesarean section rates, the risks associated with VBAC and how these can be appropriately managed, as well as the risks associated with vaginal swabbing babies born by a C-section and the use of vacuum and forceps instrumentation. I found our chat absolutely fascinating. I'm so grateful to Dr. Nathan for generously giving up his time to speak with me. I hope you enjoy it. Feedback and comments via social media or www.michelleleone.com.au are always welcome. Ken, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. I know we're on work hours technically, so time is a luxury. Are you ever truly off the clock as an obstetrician?
No. Quite simply, no. When I was in public practice, then yes. Because at that point, when you were on call, then you were on call. When we were not on call, you were free to do whatever you wanted because somebody else was covering the patients. But in full-time private practice, you are on call 24/7. So, yes. Yeah, you're on call all the time.
I thought as much. So if your phone rings, we'll forgive you for leaving.
Thank you.
So you recently invited me to speak at the VBAC workshop that you held for the public. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, we caught up for a bit of a celebratory debrief dinner.
Yes.
And I got to know that you've actually had a very colourful and interesting life. And what sort of led you to this point doing what you do now?
That is really, it's a multifactorial question.
One word answer, please.
One word. Oh, geez, there is no one word answer, to be honest. I was sent to medical school to do obstetrics. I suppose that's probably the first perspective. My family have an obstetric hospital in Kuala Lumpur, in Malaysia, where I was born. And so as a result, the onus of expectation was the fact that I would actually graduate as an obstetrician and go back and take over the family practice. But I trained in Queens, in Belfast, in the 80s, as an undergraduate. And when I qualified and worked in the NHS, which I did, in total for 23 years, I developed a passion for public practice and public medicine. And also, I suppose, in a sense, I think the important thing to understand is that 27 years ago, when I embarked on my obstetric career in the NHS, public practice was all about patient care. And private practice was all about making money. And to me, that was just the wrong way of looking at things. And what I really appreciated about the fact that when I was in the public health service was no one ever questioned how much anything cost. They just did everything to the best of their abilities, everything that the patient actually needed, so that they actually came out the other end in the best possible state that they could be. The sad reflection on modern-day society, as well as the changes that were actually inflicted on the NHS in 1993, where the hospitals were then changed to trust status by a gentleman by the name of David Willetts, who was then under John Major's government. And his idea was to try and curb the expenditure that was going beyond control of the NHS by creating each hospital as a business entity run by a chief executive officer, as opposed to what it had been, which is run by the medical director and head nurse. What we then saw was a complete spiraling out of control of the cost expenditure for administration. It was about 6% of the NHS budget was actually spent on administration in 1993. By 1997, it was 26%. A mere 5 years after the trust status had been instilled into the system. And then by 2002, which was 10 years, it exceeded 51%. So more than half the money that was allocated to healthcare and health provision was being spent on administration once this had happened. And yet we saw no visible improvement in, you know, patient outcomes. The only thing we saw was a stringent application of expenditure for healthcare provision. And a lot of that money was cut down even further because most of it was being spent on bureaucracy as opposed to provision of healthcare. So we actually ended up saving nothing. If anything, the budget actually blew out, and yet our provision of care was actually faltering. So I became then very disillusioned with public practice. And when I became a consultant in 2001 in the UK, after 8 years of seeing that health service deteriorate, when I was invited across to help with Tasmania's loss of accreditation in obstetrics and gynecological training in 2009, I was very grateful for the opportunity and took a one-year sabbatical to come across. And when I was asked to extend my contract to 2 years, I did happily and then resigned from my job in the UK in 2010 and then decided to stay here long-term. But moving to Perth was purely for access to Ireland, because my wife is Irish and she flew back twice a year to see her family. So as a result of that, we were making lots of trips with young children because we had our family here, and it just became very difficult flying to and fro from Hobart and much easier from Perth. So that's how I ended up here. And now as a full-time public private practitioner, when, you know, 27 years ago, I would have sworn never to be here.
How ironic to move to Perth, the most isolated city in the world, to be convenient.
Yes, to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
It's the most isolated city in comparison to the rest of Australia.
At the VBAC workshop, we were really delving into this concept of risk, which is what I really wanted to dive into today with you. Mm. Could you speak a bit to this concept of risk as it relates to obstetric decision-making and how that's perhaps evolved?
Yeah. So going back to what I just mentioned, how things had actually changed very significantly. When we ended up then with the elevation in bureaucracy, what with that level of bureaucracy, 50% pretty much of the NHS employment by 2001, which is now reflected here in Perth as well, what that has instilled is a lot of paperwork. Part of that paperwork comes in couched under medical terminology such as risk management or clinical governance. So what that has created is a risk-averse culture. We basically are trying to achieve the impossible, zero risk. There is no such thing, you know. Even though we can try and reduce the potential risk factors and try and bring that risk level down to a bare minimum, you can never eliminate it altogether, because you cannot predict or prevent or prepare for the unpredictable. Same thing applies every time you get behind the wheel of a car, you know? And I think that's the first thing you're going to have to accept, that even if you choose to have an elective cesarean section every single time, there is no such thing as no risk. If anything, a Caesar carries five risk factors significantly greater in all forms than a vaginal birth. So vaginal birth would be safer in those aspects. And those aspects, you know, which you can deal with individually later. But the main thing is to understand that a cesarean section is not a safer option for delivery. If it was, basically we would have no need for women to labor vaginally at all. And I think for the majority of practicing obstetricians here who don't feel passionately about vaginal birth the way I do, it would be a godsend because they could basically deliver all their patients during daylight hours and be home every night and not having to worry about being woken up in the middle of the night. But really, it's a matter of risk. And the risk is that you have to perceive what the potential risks are both ways. But ultimately, risks and benefits have to be weighed up. And that weighing up process is where considering a VBAC comes in. Because with one previous Caesar, the risk of uterine rupture, which is the main thing people are worried about, is 0.4%, or 1 in 250. That risk, in some studies, jumps up to 1 in 10 with two previous cesarean sections. So there's a significant increase in uterine rupture, purely because with two Caesars, the likelihood of dehiscence of the lower part of the uterus in labor is much higher. So ultimately, I think, you know, when we talk about risk factors and governance of risk, what we're trying to do is reduce those risk factors. So the first thing is to understand why those risks occur. When the uterus starts to contract, as it will at full term, when it needs to expel the baby from the uterus because it thinks it's fully cooked, what it will do in contracting is to try and push the baby out through the path of least resistance. And usually this is the cervix, because that is the path of least resistance, which every period comes out of prior to conception. And therefore, the uterus naturally does that. However, when you've had one previous cesarean section, there is now a second path of low resistance, which is the low wall of the uterus, which has been cut and now has scar as opposed to thick muscle, where the support should have been to facilitate passage through the cervix. So the key then is to make sure, to the best of your ability, that the cervix becomes the pathway of least resistance as opposed to the anterior wall of the uterus. So how do you do that? Encouraging cervical favorability. So how do we do that? The cervix is a canal. So there's a part of the cervix that's on the inside of the uterus called the internal os, or internal opening, and there's a bit that's actually at the top of the vagina, which is the external opening, or the external os. Now, if a baby has its head sitting down in the pelvis, meaning cephalic presentation, head coming first, from 34 weeks onwards, what I advise my moms to do is to use a Fitball, and basically sit on that for as often as they can. And when they're actually using that Fitball, they're using the baby's head to actually stretch open the internal os, which is the bit of the cervix that's inside the uterus. And then, at 37 weeks when they're full term, what I would usually offer them is an internal examination, and that would allow me to see what the external os feels like. And if that feels like a carrot, that's bad news, because it means it's completely unfavorable. If it feels like a marshmallow, that's really good news, because it means it is favorable. And cervical stimulation at that point can release local prostaglandins, which will soften the cervix and make that a more likely path for the baby's head to follow than the anterior wall of the uterus where the scar is. So when the contractions start, then the head is actually encouraged to go down the pelvis and out the cervix through the vagina, then going through the anterior wall of the uterus and into the abdominal cavity. And these are factors in which this is basically how I try and reduce risk and as a result, facilitate the success rate that I have with vaginal births after Caesars.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about the stats, I suppose, in terms of success rates? Is it something that is frequently successful?
So it depends on where you are, ultimately. And so the largest study the largest group of VBACs that we had was in 2014 in Armadale Hospital when I worked there together with my colleague Lisa Fowler, who's also very pro-vaginal birth as I am. And Armadale Hospital in 2014 had the highest successful VBAC rate in all of Australia and the third highest in Australasia. And I'm talking about Australia, not Western Australia, all of Australia. So our success rate for VBAC was 56.3%. So we had an 83% success rate for spontaneous labor for women who've had previous cesarean sections, and our success rate was 30% for inductions. So ideally, you try and avoid inducing a woman who's had a previous Caesar, because the likelihood of getting a successful VBAC would be far, far better if she was in spontaneous labor. Hence the things that I just spoke about with regards to cervical ripening, using the Fitball from 34 weeks stimulating the cervix from 37 weeks to try and encourage spontaneous labour and a favourable cervix to facilitate that. So moving on from there, the stats that we had of 56.3% was, as I say, the highest in Australia. There were two other centres in New Zealand, which were midwifery-led, that had higher successful rates on VBACs in 2014, hence making us third in Australasia, but definitely number one. And we achieved that by having an experienced team who were not part of a risk-averse culture and who basically were able to handle labour without recoursing to cesarean at the slightest provocation.
So that last statement, is that why, I guess, there is this general perception that many obstetricians do not support a VBAC? Would that
completely
be accurate?
Yes. Because, well, that would be one thing, but I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but most obstetricians would prefer to have their work cut out at 9 to 5. That was a pun. But but realistically speaking, though, that's not proper obstetrics, in my opinion. And I'm not a maverick. I just believe, and I was trained by people who felt that obstetrics was our ability to provide the best possible care for a mom to be able to labor naturally. The whole point of antenatal and obstetric care is to make sure that mom and baby remain in the best possible health up to full term to have a normal vaginal birth. That's it. And your job is to facilitate that, not to direct that birth to a timing that is convenient for you, which is sadly what happens far too often here in Perth.
Is it?
It is. So for most obstetricians, especially in private practice, who are on call 24/7, who have no time off, as the public practitioners do, because when the public practitioner on call, it's their time off, they can do whatever they want, whereas a private practitioner can't, you're on call 24/7. So to be able to give yourself a quality of life, what some practitioners unfortunately do is they try and plan the deliveries of their patients. And the only way you can actually plan that is by actually booking them in for elective caesars. So, and a lot of them now, I find, are encouraging women to actually have inductions at 39 weeks or 38 weeks with no clinical indication. And if they don't deliver by a reasonable hour after they've been induced, they're usually caesared before 8 o'clock in the evening so that the obstetrician is not woken up in the middle of the night. And that is just unethical. You see, as I mentioned in my talk, any cesarean section rate in a low to medium risk community of more than 10% has not been shown to increase maternal or fetal well-being or reduce maternal or fetal morbidity or mortality. So therefore, for a unit, so under those circumstances, for a unit dealing with low to medium risk pregnancies, a section rate of anywhere between 20 to 24%, I would say would be reasonable. If you're dealing with a high risk population, then a section rate of anywhere between 29 and 40% would be reasonable. To have a section rate of over 50% dealing with a low to medium risk population is completely unjustifiable in first world obstetrics. And third world obstetrics, maybe.
Where do we sit in Australia now or in Perth?
Well, amongst private obstetricians, anywhere between 60 and 80%.
Wow.
Do you know, my section rates for 2018 was 4.57%.
Wow.
My section rate for 2019 was 16.9%. So, obviously, 2020 is still ongoing. I hope it comes to an end soon.
What a year it's been. So, I mean, obviously, you are in a field of obstetricians who collaborate and communicate, I presume, like I do with my colleagues. Mm. Is there conflict, I mean, amongst the profession around some of these issues, or is it not talked about? Or?
I haven't hired a bodyguard yet, but I'm thinking about it. Yes, I do check underneath my car before I actually get in and turn the engine on. It's an old Northern Irish tradition. Yeah, look, you know, no one likes to speak out against their colleagues, because you just try not to. But at the same time, what I have noticed since I've come here and started practicing in Mount Lawley specifically is that the rest of my colleagues have seen how successful the VBACs are. And most of them have been raised or trained with that fear. And in a lot of cases, that fear is completely unjustified.
What is the fear? What's the reality?
Uterine rupture, horrible outcome, dead mom, dead baby.
Sure,
you know?
So that's the absolute worst outcome.
You know? But at the end of the day, the whole point of actually being trained, I mean, I tell my moms that after 27 years of having been in the most difficult of scenarios, the reason why I'm there is so that they can actually labor in peace. Because if there is something that goes wrong, I am there and I know how to deal with it. That's it. So that element of fear should no longer be part of their mindset when they are contemplating labor. Do you know, the analogy that I use is cricket, because it's the it's a game that I played at first division. Why do I pick cricket? Because it actually sits well. But you know, for those who have never watched a game of cricket before, it's going to be tough, right? And the analogy, and I use that because that's the one game that I played at first division level. And I would say that whenever you walk out onto the crease, when you're in the right frame of mind or in the zone, as I call it, you know you're automatically observing where every single fielder is. When you get to the crease, you know where they are without needing to look. And when your mind is in the right frame, that ball travels slower. You can literally pick and place where you want to put that ball because you can just see which way it's spinning in the air. You can predict which way the wicket's going to react, and you know where the fielders are, and you know where you're going to go. So therefore, when you play cricket, the wicketkeeper, the bowler, and all the fielders within earshot are constantly trying to get in your head and throw you out of that zone, right? Which happened to me, which resulted in a misjudged bounce and a fractured finger in three places. So the whole point of labor is getting in the zone. You know what you're going to have to do, right? You're walking out to that crease the minute the contractions start, okay? Your century is your delivery, right? The key is to stay on that playing field, right?
Don't leave the playing field.
Yeah, don't leave. Stay on the crease, right? And it may be, you know, it may be just 30 overs or, you know, you have to basically go the distance, right? If you're batting really well, you'll have it all done and dusted in 30 overs, right?
Some people have a test match. Some people have a big bash.
This is it. Some people have big bash. Some people have... That's a better analogy. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that one. But there you go, right? If it isn't big bash day and you're not coming in at 7 centimeters ready to push, then it's going to be, you know, it's going to be the test match, right? But you stay on that crease, be it 2 days, you be a Geoffrey Boycott. You be there for 3 days, right? No, but the thing is, so long as you're fit and healthy, and I use this analogy with all my moms, you know, if you're fit and healthy and someone asks you to run a marathon of 26 miles without a time limit, you'll get there, you know? If you have a comorbidity, obviously, something that's going to impede you from running 26 miles, and even those with comorbidity will still get there. You see? They'll just take a little bit more time. Right? But you should never be be told that, okay, fine, you've got this time limit to run your marathon when it's not a race. Right? And be told that you're going to be pulled off the course if you don't finish it in X, Y, you know, in 8 hours because of potential risk factors that might happen to you if you continue walking. You see? Worse still, to be deceived into believing that there are very viable risks which may not actually exist.
I find that frightening.
That's what's happening.
That makes me sad.
It makes me frustrated. Because it's bad. It's bad practice. And it basically tars the rest of us who are trying to do the best that we can with the same brush. You know, especially when you get some militant people, keyboard warriors, who basically go out, you know, lambasting all private obstetricians. And, we're not all that way. You know, you can't chastise the masses for the crimes of the few.
That's true.
You see? In this case, probably, you know, yeah, there are probably more than a few, but still. Anyway.
Tricky car on the way out.
I will. It's parked in a secure car park, but still check it anyway.
So, in terms of what constitutes higher risk, is that different for women seeking a VBAC, or is it the same things you're looking
for? Oh, look, I mean, the risk factor there is the fact that you're dealing with a scarred uterus, you know. Much like someone who's had previous myomectomies, removal of fibroids, it's also a scarred uterus. But if you don't give it a try, you'll never know. Do you know? You know, even with someone in a wheelchair attempts to do a 26-mile marathon, right? You can't just say you're in a wheelchair, you can't do it.
Chances
Everyone deserves a chance, right? And if you don't make it, fine, you don't make it. That's the time. And, you know, and to obviously do it in an environment where you have the option of actually saying, look, you know, have someone who's there, who's able to recognize the potential signs that you're not going to make it. You know, you're not just going to rupture your uterus from neighboring 1 minute, you know, to being, you know, hemorrhage. See, what people don't understand is people's concept of rupture, the term rupture, you know, implies torn muscle, big blood vessels, pouring blood. That's not how the low uterine segment ruptures in labor. It actually stretches at the point of least weakness, which is the scar, or rather greatest weakness, least strength. And that scar doesn't have blood vessels in it. So what happens is it actually just thins out and then opens up. But the edges are not like cut muscle when you're doing an elective seizure, where you're actually cutting into the actual healthy muscle of the uterus with excellent blood supply. That pours blood everywhere. You know, with a seizure, your blood loss is twice as great as it is with a normal delivery. With a dehiscence, that's exactly what it is. It's dehiscing, thins out. The problem is the membranes rupture, baby's now inside the abdomen, and there's a time frame of actually trying to get the abdomen open and the baby out. But even then, it doesn't always mean that the membranes rupture straight into the abdominal cavity. That's only if you fail to recognize the signs of dehiscence. And what are the signs of dehiscence? A slow progression in labor. You wouldn't leave someone with a previous seizure who's contracting 4 in 10, as in 4 contractions every 10 minutes, stuck at 6 centimeters for 8 hours.
Okay, so that, would there be a little bit more monitoring?
Of course.
Yeah.
You see? Mm-hmm. Because that's why I keep an eye. That's why I'm there. I'm there to say, okay, look, you're not making progress. So the reason why you're not making progress is because your uterus has found another path of least resistance, as opposed to, because if the pelvis, your vagina and your pelvic floor remained the path of least resistance, your cervix wouldn't have stopped dilating. You would have continued to go down that road. The fact that it has stopped dilating means that the uterus has now found a secondary area of weakness through which it's beginning to push through. And that's usually the lower segment where the previous second scar was, right? And so how do we figure that out? Well, several ways. The fact that the labor is not progressing is one, in the presence of regular uterine activity. Sometimes that may be due to malpositioning of the head, and changing the position of the head can actually facilitate the ease of passage of the head down the pelvis and reverse the trend of the path of least resistance from being the front wall of the uterus back to being the cervix and vagina again. And it's just it's the question of detection and management and intervention appropriately if needed.
Mm.
Yeah. But the whole point is that if you don't try, you'll never know.
Mm. Yeah. I feel like women who have had a cesarean that they didn't want and are pursuing a VBAC are particularly passionate about it, I suppose, which I can understand. How do you approach, I guess, those initial consults in terms of, you know, encouraging them or talking about success rates?
Yeah. So the point is for them to understand, right, that the priority is a healthy mom and a healthy baby, right? Not VBAC at all cost.
Mm.
If they are of the mindset that they want a VBAC at all cost, I don't take them on.
Mm.
Because that's irrational thinking, right? You've lost the plot and you don't actually understand why you're pregnant in the first place. Okay? Realistically.
Yeah.
You're pregnant because you want to be pregnant, because you want to bring a healthy baby into this world, right? And even if this was your first pregnancy and you've never had a seizure, there is still a significant chance if something does go wrong, you could end up with one. And why do we do the CSER? Because we're trying to reduce the likelihood of an adverse outcome. And that's essentially what we're doing. And that is what a CSER is there for. Not for convenience, but for where you perform a CSER when the risk of not performing a CSER is greater than performing a CSER. See? So there's no way, I don't have a magic wand to actually say, you know, thou shalt have a VBAC and thou shalt not. Ultimately, we work together as a team to produce or create the best possible circumstances for a VBAC in the hope that it will be successful. There's no guarantee. But the main thing is, we go through this journey, we try it out, if it works, and my success rates have been pretty good, then well and good. But, you know, they're my success rates. And in a sense, you know, I get asked a lot. And certainly, you know, keyboard warriors that actually go on to various Facebook pages and chat groups have questioned my ideology and, you know, my modus operandi and how I actually go about achieving this. And they say, oh, but where's the evidence for this and where's the evidence for that? My stretches and sweeps, you know, where's the evidence? And my answer to them is very, very simple. What does the term evidence mean to you? And to those people, and essentially, you know, the term evidence is basically the documented statistical accumulation of somebody else's experience. And the reason why you need evidence is because you don't have that experience. I am not inexperienced. And that's pretty much it. You see? So, for those who haven't been practicing for 27 years, your only source of information is your so-called evidence, which is a documentation of somebody else's experience. You know, so if that's what you want to do, then by all means, use what evidence you have and do what you need to do. But don't waste the time of someone who actually has experience by trying to challenge them without having experience of your own.
I wanted to change gears a little. I've heard some evidence that suggests that vaginal delivery may create a more favourable microbiome for the baby. So in terms of immunity gained from the mother. Is there any truth to that, do you know? Or are there any specific benefits from vaginal birth over cesarean other than, you know, the obvious?
So I think, you know, the one thing that we must always... We've forgotten a lot as a species, right? And I keep reiterating this every time I give my talks. The female pelvis was meant to bear children from puberty, right? The actual pelvis itself is made up of three parts. The sacrum is the base of the spine and the two hip bones. And those two hip bones come in three parts, the ilium, the ischium, and the pubis with cartilage in between. It doesn't actually ossify into one solid bone on either side until you're 23 to 25. Your pelvic floor is at its most flexible, malleable, the musculature, the levator ani, at that time. And the uterine muscle is at its softest, most pliable, both for implantation and for contraction in labor, to facilitate the passage of birth through the pelvic floor. But more importantly, and the reason why it happened at that time, because we are cavemen, right? And our life expectancy was very, very short. So 35, 40 was pretty much, you know, a good innings. Living up to 45 was, you were the matriarch of the clan, if you got that old. So that was why that was the optimal time to actually have children. You know, when your pelvic floor was, it was in that situation, your pelvic floor and in the entire pelvis itself. But more importantly, when you were having your children, you were delivering in caves, in filth and squalor. Do you understand? So a preterm baby, for example. So what tends to happen? There's two main reasons why term babies, well, I suppose two, amongst many reasons, but two very significant ones, is that babies that are actually born at full term, from about 34, 35 weeks onwards, they start building up brown fat between their shoulder blades. And that brown fat, inside the abdomen is 37 degrees. Outside, in room temperature, is 20 to 22 degrees at best. So that's a 15 to 17 degree temperature drop. And so for a baby to be brought out of the 37 degree environment into a 20 to 22 degree environment is the same as one of us being thrown into a bucket of water that's 3 degrees and expected to stay there, right? So you need to have something that's going to keep you warm. And that brown fat is highly thermogenic. So it basically creates heat and allows the baby to cope. That's why you'll find that babies, when they're born at full term, will actually lose weight because they actually burn their brown fat until day three, day four. And they don't actually pick up back to their birth weight again until day 7 to day 10. And that is because of the loss of the brown fat to actually keep them warm and acclimatizing themselves to the change in temperature. The second thing is the thymus gland. So the thymus is a small lump of lymphocytic tissue that's behind the sternum that term babies are born with. And that is chock-a-block full of lymphocytes. That gives you the immunity to deal with all sorts of bugs that you're going to encounter when you are born in the shit and squalor of that cave floor. Right? And if you don't have a well-developed thymus gland, or you're not a term baby that's healthy, you will die. That's called survival of the fittest, right? So exposure to the bacteria, any sort of bacteria at that early stage, allows for a term baby to develop immunity, not just to that bug, but stimulates an immune system so that it can develop it to exposure to anything else that it's going to be exposed to in the weeks and months to come, especially when they start crawling around. Our problem nowadays is we treat babies, you know, we wrap them up in cotton wool, and we don't actually expose them to the bacteria that they should naturally be exposed to had they been term babies. Totally different story if you're a preterm and you don't actually have a well-developed thymus gland or the capability of dealing with temperature change. So for those babies, you need to be very careful with them. Otherwise, you're going to put them into a state of morbidity that they won't be able to spiral out of. So that's really where all that comes down to. There's a fact that, you know, exposure to bacteria for term babies is not a bad idea. With regards to actually infecting babies with vaginal secretions if they're born by Caesar, the evidence for that is definitely not compelling. Mm-hmm. And there's already a case now from the eastern states where a baby actually became septic and died as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's only one way for the mom, you know, is to deny all culpability and responsibility. Because otherwise, how do you live with yourself? You know, having literally killed your own baby by introducing bacteria to it. Sorry, I do apologize. I think, you know, there's all well and good reading the literature, right? But just let nature take its course. You can't predict or force every outcome, really. I mean, I know that. As a surgeon, I do the best that I can for my patients. But I always speak to them about all the potential risks associated with the surgery and the fact that I cannot predict or prevent all the potential outcomes that I would like to avoid. So, and in the same way, you know, to go by some advice that someone gives you on the internet that you think is valid, well, look, if it actually is going to bring about a significant improvement in outcome that you feel is worthwhile and that the risk justifies the ends, then fine, go ahead and do it. But when you end up with that adverse outcome that potentially could have happened, take it on the nose and accept responsibility for your actions.
Mm. You did mention at the talk one of the benefits of vaginal delivery in terms of the baby is the squish on the lungs.
Yes. The whole passage of the vagina and the pelvic floor is actually designed specifically for childbirth. The first thing is, you know, how does a human being, a Neanderthal, know how to deliver a baby? And quite simply, as you know, the shape of the pelvic floor is such that it's the C-shaped, it's shaped so that when the head actually meets it, it naturally flexes and rotates the head. That's basically what happens to the shape of the head as it hits the pelvic floor. But more importantly, when that head comes up to the pelvic floor, the sensation is what you and I feel every single morning, hopefully, if your bowels are regular, and you do what comes naturally. You sit and you squat. And when you're sitting and squatting, you're basically facilitating the flexion and rotation of the fetal head within the pelvis. That's the reason why the pelvis is shaped the way it is. So why does the fetal head need to flex and rotate? The pelvic entry at the pelvic brim, the true entry, is actually its width from right to left is the widest part. Whereas the pelvic exit is widest from front to back. So basically the head has to enter the pelvis looking either right or left, and then rotate 90 degrees and exit the pelvis looking either up or down, preferably down. So when that happens, and the pelvic floor is shaped so that when whichever way the head enters, either looking right or left, it will flex and rotate looking down so that the occiput is delivered first, which is the back of the head. And that's how if you're in a squatting position, that's essentially what will happen. And the sensation of that head hitting the pelvic floor is the same as if your bowels are moving. So your natural instinct is to sit, squat, and push. And lo and behold, you give birth. And so that natural thing is actually how we've actually evolved. And we need to continue to evolve in that situation. But when it comes to the tone of the pelvic floor, the problem that we're now faced with is when that tone is lost, then the head doesn't flex or rotate either. See? Following on from the natural birth, the reason why the pelvic floor, the rotation, your shoulders are 90 degrees to your head. If you consider that your anteroposterior is from the front to the back of your head, then your shoulders themselves are 90 degrees to that. And once the head's actually come through the pelvis, it needs to rotate that 90 degrees so the shoulders can actually enter. And once the head is actually delivered, the shoulders are then squeezed through the pelvic floor. And in that squeezing process, the fluid that's within the lungs that had been in utero are now, because the nose is delivered, as is the upper airway, squeezed out of the upper airway, and that all comes bubbling out of the baby's nose and mouth, and then when the chest is then delivered from the pelvis as an out the vagina, the chest expands and draws air in through the upper airways into the lungs and fills it up for the first time. So that facilitates natural breathing. A baby born by cesarean section is basically pulled out of the abdomen without any sort of squeezing process. And as a result, for term babies, the lungs are still chock-a-block full of fluid and the baby's delivered. So the one thing that they tend to suffer from, more often than not, is a condition called transient tachypnea of the newborn, where the baby ends up taking multiple short, shallow breaths because its lungs are still chock-a-block full of fluid because they haven't been squeezed to expel that fluid. And so therefore they can't function normally until that fluid is resorbed back into the fetal circulation. And that usually can take 24 to 48 hours.
And does that have any long-term effects, or that's a very short-term?
Short-term, most of it is short-term. Because even babies born vaginally will have some degree of fluid in their lungs, which will get resorbed. So the effects are relatively short-term, unless there's an infective component. So, because having fluid, obviously, within the lungs, it is basically a perfect nidus for infection. And if infection does take hold there, then you could end up with very severe and adverse, you know, severe and poor outcomes for the baby.
Is there any known evidence for more adverse health outcomes of vaginal versus cesarean in the long term?
For babies? Mm. Not that you could actually hang your hat on, realistically.
Yeah.
But if you consider, you know, the colonization of the baby born by Caesar with vaginal bacteria, when his lungs are chock-a-block full of fluid, and they haven't been, the fluid hasn't been pushed out, it's just a perfect little pond for breeding bugs.
Mm. Yeah, true. Mm. Okay, I have two more key questions that wanted to ask.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, as you talked about opening your bowels, using gravity to assist the birthing process and that sort of reflexive posture, it feels more natural and we're utilizing gravity.
Mm-hmm.
What's your philosophy, I suppose, on epidurals and being able to maintain an upright posture for fertility?
Yes. So this is what I advise all my moms, right? I would never advise any of them to forego an epidural. What I advise my moms is to use all other means of analgesia until they get to about 6 centimeters. So why that crucial 6 centimeters? Because as a rule, when you get to 6 centimeters, the head is usually already flexed and rotated because it's low enough down the pelvis to actually stretch the cervix open to 6 centimeters. And when that is done, then the most important part, and the part when the mom's actually most uncomfortable, is basically the stretching of the lower part of the vagina and the perineum, and of course the introitus, which is the entry of the vagina. That's when they would really feel discomfort as the head descends, and that's when they really need the epidural. By that stage, the head would have already flexed and rotated. So it's unlikely that the epidural is likely to create stagnation and labor. Your momentum's already been built up, and yet it's still long enough for it to have its effect. because it's unlikely that you're going to go from 6 centimeters to delivery within 25 minutes to half an hour. So that's usually what I advise my moms, to use Antinox, to use pethidine, morphine, anything in their power that they can use so that they can still mobilize in that football and try and keep themselves as upright as possible until they get to that 6 centimeter point. And then once they get past that, then by all means go for an epidural. Because that's usually when they will really feel the need for it. Sadly, though, Jennifer Aniston has done us a disservice. Because in the one episode of Friends when she was pregnant, the first thing that she screamed for was an epidural and got one and then was paralyzed in labor. And then this baby's head just miraculously appeared from between her legs.
Naturally.
And people need to understand that that is so far from reality.
The movies have done us all a big disservice. I was devastated when my waters didn't dramatically break on the carpet and
spill halfway across the room.
Exactly. And my final question that I really wanted to ask was just, so, you know, vacuum and forceps.
Mm-hmm.
We know that there is an association, well, an increased risk of pelvic floor dysfunction the more intervention that is utilized in terms of postpartum outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts or belief about that?
Chopsticks in the right hands are perfect utensils for enjoying a lovely meal. Chopsticks in the wrong hands are a lethal weapon.
My son at Yum Cha on the weekend.
There you go, right? Yeah. So, you know, forceps in the right hands are a beautiful, delicate instrument. And it's an art form as to how you use them. Forceps in the wrong hands are a lethal weapon. I see that, I think, is a primary problem. Nowadays, when I came through the training system in the early 90s, first of all, our anaesthetists weren't competent at putting in epidurals. So you basically, if you needed a seizure, had to have it done under general anaesthetic. And if you were doing an instrumental delivery, you had to do it under a pudendal block, which you had to administer yourself because you couldn't get an anaesthetist to come in. So as a result, you became very careful with your application of instruments. And you were shown how to do it properly one time, and then you were guided through it a second time. And then you just became very careful because your patient rapidly told you just how competent you were as a practitioner because they didn't have the blessing of an epidural. And you learned very quickly what was permissible and what was not. And it was very hard to create an adverse outcome in a poorly anaesthetized patient. And as a result, and of course we had sheer volume of work because there were very few trainees then. We worked ridiculous hours. I was contracted for 95 hours a week. I worked in excess of 110. So I was paid for 95 hours. But, you know, the majority of hours we worked, we were never paid for. But we were given free accommodation in the hospital. Our food was subsidized. And we were treated as part of a family. So it was very different. You actually felt a part of that unit when you were working there. And so the hours of training meant that you became comfortable in the use of the instruments. And you would have probably done 2 to 3 instrumental deliveries for every cesarean. Today's trainee has probably done 10 to 20 cesareans to one instrumental delivery, if they've even done an instrumental delivery. So I've seen patients come to me time and time again who've had cesarean sections done at full dilatation because the obstetrician wasn't brave enough or competent enough to actually apply a forceps or a vacuum for the delivery. And to be honest, if they've chosen such an obstetrician, then that would be the right decision because their baby would have been better off being delivered by a Caesar than by an incompetent obstetrician who's unfamiliar in the use of instruments like forceps or vacuum. But you should not allow the statistics of those who haven't been adequately trained to mar the overall use of the instrument itself. The classic thing in the United States is that, you know, we say guns don't kill people. People kill people. You cannot blame the guns for the death rate, right? But at the same time, you know, removing the guns is everyone's, you know, they think this is the right answer. And it's the same thing that happened. You know, people stopped having forceps on the wards in public hospitals. They took the Keelan's forceps away because Keelan's are associated with a higher risk of maternal or fetal injury. Wrong. Incompetent practitioners with a pair of Keelan's forceps in their hands are associated with a higher risk of maternal and fetal injury. The forceps themselves do nothing. You see? Mm. If you're if you're not adequately trained, for the love of God, don't be using the instrument. Do you know? But don't take the instrument off the floor just because there's incompetent people about. Do you know?
Mm.
So, yeah. If you and in the same way, I'm sure in some bizarre world guns have their uses, but you can't actually blame a device for an adverse outcome or an adverse culture.
That's a very fair point.
Mm.
The gun doesn't pull its own trigger.
No.
Which leads me really nicely into my final question. What would you suggest to a woman looking for an obstetrician?
It really depends on what she wants, right? It really depends on what she wants. And ultimately, so what do you mean, what does she want? Every woman wants to go through, you know, pregnancy through the best possible, you know, and basically have the best possible outcome. So if you have underlying conditions that you already know about, then you want to pick such as diabetes, such as multiple medical conditions that are going to need to be monitored, then you would want to pick an obstetrician who deals with high-risk obstetrics and who is competent and comfortable in dealing with those cases, not just a newly qualified obstetrician who probably doesn't have the experience in dealing with that, but who would like to think they do. So that's one factor. But if you're otherwise low-risk and have few complications, then what you have to decide is how you want to deliver. And if you want to deliver by a planned Caesar and pick your time and date of birth for the baby, then probably 90% of the obstetricians here in Perth would be suitable for you. Probably more than 90%. If, however, you want to have a vaginal birth, then the first question you need to ask any obstetrician before you book in with them is what their section rate is.
Mm. So you can literally ring the clinic and ask for those stats. Yeah, I love
it. And if they say, oh, we don't have our stats, they're lying. We all have our stats. And if that stat is over 60% or over 50% or over 40% in a low-risk practice, look elsewhere.
Thank you. That's very practical advice.
Yeah.
Love it. Ken, thank you so much. Do you have any parting words to...
Not at all, no. I'm always glad to talk to my patients and talk about obstetrics. It's something that I'm very, very passionate about. Something that I like to try and instill with my students. Because they see that. They sit in the room and they see me having fun every day with my patients. And my patients have fun with me. They know I have a sense of humor. They know that most of them come in with a whole pile of literature. And that literature that they're actually hiding behind is basically their fear. They're afraid. They're afraid they've made the wrong decision. They're afraid that what they've been led to believe may not be true. They're afraid of being misled because most of them have already been misled by an obstetrician, one of my, you know, kith and kin who are out there practicing, and therefore they've ended up here and they don't know whether they're going to be just taken on another joyride. And that's really very sad. And I'm just perfectly frank with them and I tell them what I tell everyone. You know, here are the risks, here are the benefits, here are my stats, and this is what I've achieved. And to be honest, the fact that you're actually sitting in front of me is because you've actually read about me already. And if there's anything that you'd like to, you know, question or ask, I'm more than happy to clarify. But sadly, my one problem at the minute now is the fact that my clinics are fully booked until the middle of March. So I have no capacity to actually... I'm trying to free up as many spaces as possible. I'm trying to call up most of my patients who don't physically need to see me to try and create spaces that I can actually then leave open. And I've told my girls now to leave a certain number of slots for antenatal patients so that I can continue to keep practicing. Otherwise, I'll just have no capacity for anyone. And that's the tricky bit.
Mm.
And if that is the case, I apologize in advance. But I'm trying to do the best that I can to improve things in the months to come.
And you're only one man. So let's hope that others come on board.
And they do, because the VBAC rates, success rates, are actually improving for all my other colleagues in this hospital as well.
Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. Once they see that it's not as risky as they've been led to believe, most of them are willing. And we're very fortunate here in Mount Lawley. And I say that because we get along very well together. And not one of them is afraid to pick up the phone and ask for help. And I only live 900 meters away from this hospital. And I'm pretty much available 24/7. So if one of them does run into difficulties, I'm more than willing and happy to come in and help out.
I think that's the key.
Yes.
Ken, thank you so much.
Not at all. Let's wrap it up.
Hey, want more Thrive in your life? Head over to www.michelleleone.com.au to find out more, get in touch, or hit us up on the socials, which I do check occasionally. Once again, thank you for joining the conversation. And remember, no matter what's going on in your life, you are not alone.